Welcome to The Juice Today, an audio edition of The Juice that lets educators and parents stay informed about what their students are reading.
Welcome to The Deep Dive.
Let's do it.
First up, an article about speed, really pushing the limits, but with robotics this time. It involves a Rubik's Cube.
Ah, yes, the Purduvix Cube robot. This was built by undergraduates at Purdue University, Matthew Patrahey, Jen Piotta, Aiden Hurd, and Alex Berta. And, well, what they did is pretty remarkable.
Remarkable is definitely the word. So this robot holds the Guinness World Record, fastest Rubik's Cube solver.
And the time is just staggering.
It's 103 milliseconds. That's 0.103 seconds. Hard to even grasp.
Yeah, it really is. The article helps by comparing it to the human record holder, Max Park. He takes just over 3 seconds.
Okay.
So this robot is like 30 times faster. It solves the cube more than 3 times quicker than you can blink.
Wow. 3 times faster than a blink. How does the article say it actually works? What's the tech?
Well, it uses 6 special rotator arms, so it can turn all the sides of the cube at the same time.
Ah, okay. Simultaneously.
Exactly. And it has color sensors that read the cube's pattern almost instantly. Then custom algorithms, ones the students wrote, figure out the fastest solution.
So it's the reading, the calculation, and the simultaneous movement all combined.
Right. That's where the incredible speed comes from.
The article mentioned previous records too, didn't it?
It did. Mitsubishi held it before this just under 400 milliseconds. And another college team from MIT, they got it down to 380 milliseconds.
And that MIT video was actually the inspiration here.
Yeah, the article quotes one of the students, Matthew Patrahey. He said he saw that MIT video back in high school and just thought, that's cool, I want to try and beat that.
That's great. Shows how that competitive spark drives innovation.
Definitely. It's not just about the record itself, but that whole process of seeing something impressive and thinking we can push that further. It really fuels technological progress.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, so from pushing tech limits, let's pivot. A different kind of smarts. This time in nature. An article took us to West Orange, New Jersey, of all places.
Right. This was a really cool story about a Cooper's hawk. A zoologist, Vladimir D. Netz, watched it over a winter.
And saw something unusual.
Very unusual. This hawk developed this really specific hunting strategy using the urban environment. He actually published it, calling it an impressive feat of intelligence.
Okay. So how did this city hawk operate? What did the article describe?
Well, it started pretty normally. People nearby would throw out breadcrumbs.
Attracting small birds.
Yeah.
Sparrows, doves.
Exactly. But the hawk didn't just dive in. It would perch up on a roof nearby and wait.
Wait for what?
For pedestrians, the article mentions kids going to school, joggers to push the crossing button at a busy intersection nearby.
Ah, to stop the traffic.
Right. The lights turn red, cars stop. And crucially, the line of stopped cars would stretch past the house with the breadcrumbs.
Creating a kind of visual barrier.
Precisely. But here's the kicker. The crossing sign, the one for visually impaired people, it makes a beeping sound.
Yeah.
According to the article, that beep was the hawk's cue.
You're kidding? The beep?
That's what Dinette's observed. The hawk seemed to learn that the boop meant traffic was stopped and the cars provided cover. So when it heard the beep, it swooped down, used the cars to hide its approach.
Wow.
And then darting out from between 2 vehicles to catch the smaller birds.
That's incredible. It learned to use traffic signals and stopped cars as hunting tools. And the article said it only did this on weekdays.
Yeah, another key detail. Suggesting it understood the traffic patterns were different, more reliable for this trick, on weekdays.
So Dinette's concluded this shows maybe birds of prey are smarter, more adaptable than we thought.
Exactly. That level of planning, using specific urban cues, it really challenges our assumptions about animal intelligence, especially how they adapt to, you know, human-dominated environments.
Makes you look twice at the pigeons in the park, maybe.
Well, maybe not the pigeons quite like that, but definitely the raptors.
Right. Okay, moving from animal ingenuity to human creativity, focused on the environment. We had a couple of articles here, one tackling waste, one about protecting habitats.
Yeah, showing that same kind of problem solving, just applied differently, essential for sustainability.
So first, used cooking oil.
Mm.
Big problem from restaurants pollutes, if dumped, can be toxic. What was the solution highlighted in the article?
This piece focused on Sustenta. It's an NGO, a non-governmental organization down in Honduras.
Mm-hmm.
And their approach is really smart. They go to restaurants and collect the used cooking oil. They actually pay the restaurants a bit for it, like 15 cents a pound for the grease.
So An incentive not to just pour it down the drain. What do they do with it?
They use technology to purify it. Then they mix it with lye that's, you know, a chemical base through a process called saponification.
Saponification, that
thing. That's right. Exactly. Soap. They turn this wust grease into bars of soap. And the article also mentioned they use other byproducts to make dog food.
Wow. So turning waste into actual products. And it's sustainable.
Apparently so. The article said they have a deal with Walmart in Central America to sell the soap and the dog food. It keeps the whole operation running.
That's a fantastic example of a circular economy.
Precisely.
Okay.
And the motivation seems key. The director, Ricardo Pineda, was quoted saying they wanted actual solutions, not just talk. Another manager, Hugo Daniel Chavez, talked about giving waste a second life.
That really resonates. Moving beyond just identifying problems.
It's a great model for how social enterprises can blend environmental good with economic stability.
Okay, so from transforming waste to preserving something precious. This next article had a surprising reveal about rainforests.
Yeah, most of us think Amazon, right? Or maybe Southeast Asia. But this article talks about temperate rainforests found along the coasts of the UK, Wales, Ireland, sometimes called the Celtic rainforest.
Celtic rainforest? I honestly didn't know that was a thing in the UK. What's their status?
Well, the article says they're basically scattered fragments now. Small pockets, but incredibly rich in life.
Yeah.
Thousands of species, lots of rare and endangered ones.
But they're threatened.
Very much so. Facing an extinction crisis, according to the conservationists in the article, climate change, invasive species, human activity, the usual pressures, but hitting these small areas hard.
How small are we talking?
Only about 128 square miles left in total. It's tiny.
That's not much at all.
No. And the article gave a really stark example of their vulnerability.
What was that?
An ecologist, Sabine Nouvet, described a 500-year-old oak tree that got blown down in a storm. A tragedy in itself, but...
But there was more to it.
Yes. There was a tiny species of lichen that apparently only lived on ancient oaks like that one, 300 years or older, within that specific rainforest patch. When the tree fell, that lichen species was instantly lost from that site. They tried to save samples, but...
Gone. Just like that. Because one tree fell.
It just shows how interconnected everything is and how devastating the loss of one key element can be in these fragmented ecosystems, a whole species potentially wiped out.
Makes you realize the importance of every single patch.
Absolutely. Adam Thorogood from Plant Life, they're working on conservation there. He was quoted urging much stricter protections and just raising awareness. This amazing habitat is, as he put it, right on your doorstep.
A powerful reminder that vital conservation needs aren't always somewhere far away. Sometimes they're much closer than we think.
And that loss can happen incredibly fast, especially in these small, isolated remnants.
Okay, let's shift now to our quote of the day. This one feels like it ties into several themes we've touched on. Exploration, sharing knowledge, passion.
Yes, this is from Jacques Cousteau. The quote is, "When one man, for whatever reason, has the opportunity to lead an extraordinary life, he has no right to keep it to himself."
And that really sums up his own life, doesn't it? The article reminded us French naval officer, explorer, huge pioneer in marine conservation, lived 1910 to 1997.
His impact was immense. He co-developed the aqualung. That fundamentally changed underwater exploration, letting people actually stay down there and see things.
Opened up a whole new world.
It really did, for science, for everyone.
And he definitely lived by that quote. He didn't keep it to himself. The undersea world of Jacques Cousteau. That TV series brought the oceans into people's homes globally.
Exactly. Millions saw it. It wasn't just, look at this cool fish. It inspired a whole generation to care about the oceans. He connected exploration directly to conservation.
He was a huge advocate, wasn't he? The article mentioned him campaigning against pollution, overfishing, really raised awareness about the threats.
A tireless advocate. He blended the science, the technology, like the aqualung and that public communication so effectively. He won tons of awards, UN Environmental Prize, U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom.
He truly walked the talk of that quote. Sharing his extraordinary life, his discoveries, and using that platform to push for conservation. It connects back to, you know, the people finding solutions for waste or trying to save those rainforests. That idea of sharing what you know or what you can do.
It highlights that responsibility that comes with opportunity, whether it's exploring the deep sea or finding a local solution. Knowledge grows when it's shared.
Okay, for our final article today, we're changing lanes significantly, moving into national policy and its global effects.
Right, this piece examined a specific proclamation signed by President Trump.
The main action it described was a ban preventing travelers from about a dozen countries, mostly in Africa and the Middle East, from entering the U.S., plus some partial restrictions on others.
Mm-hmm.
The article listed the nations facing the full ban: Afghanistan, Myanmar, Chad, Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. And Cuba had partial limits.
And the article cited the stated reason within the proclamation.
Yes, it quoted the proclamation as citing an imminent need to protect Americans from foreign terrorists and other national security and public safety threats. That was the official justification presented.
Okay. The article also provided some context around this.
It did. It mentioned this was part of a broader immigration crackdown during President Trump's time in office, giving examples like deportations of Venezuelans and denying entry to some students. It also included a quote from President Trump about adding countries if threats emerge and saying, quote, "We will not allow people to enter our country who wish to do us harm."
So that's the framing from the administration side of national security. But the article also included reactions from others, right?
Yes, it noted concern from leaders in the affected nations. Specifically, it mentioned the African Union Commission, the AUC.
And what was their stance, according to the article?
The article reported the AUC stated this order would harm U.S.-African relations, diplomatic, educational, business ties. They asked for a more consultative approach and constructive dialogue.
So, concern about the broader relationship impact. Did the article mention the conditions in any of the banned countries?
Briefly, yes. It noted that some, like Haiti and Sudan, were dealing with really severe issues: political instability, civil unrest, hunger, war, causing large numbers of people to flee as refugees.
Providing that humanitarian context and any historical perspective.
It did mention President Trump's first-term travel ban, which targeted several majority Muslim countries, faced court challenges, and was ultimately repealed by President Biden in 2021.
So looking at this article, it really lays out the competing frames. You have the government's stated national security rationale on one side, and on the other, you have the concerns from affected nations about diplomacy, existing relationships, business, education, plus the underlying humanitarian situations in some of those places. The article presents both viewpoints.
It really highlights that tension that often exists between a nation's perceived security needs and its international relationships and, well, humanitarian responsibility.
A complex balancing act, for sure. Lots to chew on from these articles.
Definitely food for thought. We hope this deep dive gave you some interesting perspectives and sparked some new ideas. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this overview of The Juice Today. Students read these stories at their own reading levels to improve their comprehension, vocabulary, critical thinking, and more. Learn more at thejuicelearning.com.